Today is Thursday, November 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Ruafo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, a brutal loss in blue-leaning Virginia state sends divided Democrats in Washington scrambling for answers.
People are upset and uncertain about a lot of things, from COVID to school to jobs.
Ethiopia reacts to a damning UN report of atrocities committed in the Tigray conflict.
The Ethiopian Prime Minister did not reject it, but he said he has serious reservations about it. He said he would set up a joint civilian-military task force.
And African nations at COP26 criticize rich countries for failing to meet $1 billion pledge to mitigate climate change. We'll have this story and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. On Tuesday, the Democratic Party suffered a surprising loss in the governor's race in Virginia, while a two-class for comfort vote in New Jersey sent divided Democrats in Washington scrambling for answers Wednesday. Many Democrats are calling for new strategies to unstick a stalled legislative agenda in the U.S. Congress before they sustain more political damage. Republican Glenn Youngkin edged Democratic former Governor Terry McAuliffe in Virginia, erasing President Joe Biden's 10 percentage point margin of victory just a year ago. U.S. President Joe Biden reacted on Wednesday evening to the Democratic Party's election loss, saying that, quote, people are upset and uncertain about a lot of things, unquote, and that he will push ahead with his legislative agenda.
What I do know is that people want us to get things done. And that's why I'm continuing to push very hard for the Democratic Party to move along and pass my infrastructure bill and my Build Back Better bill. People are upset and uncertain about a lot of things, from COVID to school to jobs to a whole range of things and the cost of the gallon of gasoline. And so if I'm able to pass, sign into law, my Build Back Better initiative, I'm in a position where you're going to see a lot of those things ameliorated quickly and swiftly. I think we should have passed before Election Day, but I'm not sure that I would be able to have changed the number of very conservative folks who turned out in the red districts who were Trump voters. But maybe I was running against Donald Trump.
That's U.S. President Joe Biden. For a look at the mood inside the White House in reaction to the defeat, I spoke with VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell.
Some are categorizing this as a big blow to the Biden presidency, that this is a test of confidence in this administration.
How big of a blow would you say this is, especially when the president appears to be popular in Virginia, a state he won by about 10 points?
There are a lot of ways to look at that. And I think we're going to hear some critics of the president say this is a very damaging body blow that from which he will never recover. And probably the White House is going to try to seek to minimize this. The place that we're going to see this play out is probably in Congress, where we see how Congress people react to defeat of Democrats in terms of negotiating this enormous multi-trillion dollar spending package. We will see that in coming days. Right now, the White House has basically sent out proxies to say, hey, this isn't going to really hurt us that much. This loss in Virginia is not going to set us back in our quest to pass these spending plans that they argue help Americans and provide much needed services for Americans. But I think that remains to be seen, and we'll be watching the Hill.
The blame game and finger pointing has started among the Democrats. Even Senator Kaine of Virginia is blaming both the moderates and also the progressives being responsible for what happened. Will this further complicate the efforts of the president to unite the party to achieve something before the midterm?
Probably. This is politics played at a high level in the style of Washington, D.C. But probably some people will argue that this is going to really hurt the administration in terms of implementing their legislative agenda. But we will see.
The president is back from Europe, but he still faces his domestic agenda, which is passing both the hard and soft infrastructure bill. What efforts is he making? How intense is his pressure to get this over the line, especially with what happened in Virginia?
I think the Biden administration would say that they're still very seized of this matter and still working very hard to get it passed. The pressure on some of the holdouts, and I'm talking specifically about West Virginian Joe Manchin, that dynamic has changed in the last 24 hours. As we know, Joe Manchin is from a neighboring state, West Virginia, that is largely Republican. He's a lone Democrat. And so he's definitely looking at the political winds and thinking, how can I walk this tightrope and still deliver for my constituents and also also stay true to my party. It's a very difficult conversation. And I think Joe Manchin probably has more options this morning than he did yesterday. And that is because he's the lone holdout, that's going to play out in interesting ways. So it remains to be seen what could happen, how that could play out.
That's VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell. A joint probe by the United Nations and Ethiopian Humanitarian Rights Commission accuses all parties to the conflict in Ethiopia's northern Tigray province of committing human rights violations, some of which may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The report covers the period from the start of the war last year on November 3rd until June 28, 2021, when the Ethiopian government declared a unilateral ceasefire. A team of 38 investigators visited various parts of Tigray to see the impact of the conflict and conduct a total of 269 confidential interviews with victims and witnesses. The investigation team cites a litany of violations and abuses carried out by all sides. These include unlawful killings and extrajudicial executions, torture, sexual and gender-based violence, including gang rapes. It also describes violations against tens of thousands of Eritrean refugees and the forced displacement of more than 2.5 million civilians. While the investigation has ended, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, says the atrocities of what she calls this senseless war continue and are escalating and spreading to other parts of the country. Every day, she says, more people are suffering and dying.
We are receiving continued allegations of serious abuses and violations of international human rights and international humanitarian law. There are reports of shelling and airstrikes resulting in civilian death, summary executions, large-scale displacement, and a worsening humanitarian situation.
The High Commissioner says the blocking of humanitarian aid to civilians has resulted in some 5 million people suffering from acute hunger, with 400,000 on the verge of famine. Bachelet says most of the violations appear to have been committed by Ethiopian and Eritrean forces. However, she notes that since the cutoff date of the investigation, an increasing number of allegations of human rights abuses by Tigrayan forces have been reported as well.
A key concern of our report is due accountability. National authorities have the primary responsibility to deliver fair and independent proceedings that address the full range of violations identified rather than isolated individual instances. It is crucial that the governments of Ethiopia and Eritrea ensure that those responsible for serious human rights violations are held accountable, regardless of the affiliation of the perpetrators.
Eritrean Information Minister Yamane Meskel called the report utterly false in a tweet Wednesday. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said he accepted the report despite some serious reservations. He noted that it did not accuse his government of genocide or using food as a weapon. Abiy said a joint civilian military task force would be set up to investigate the report's allegations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The new United Nations report comes a day before the war's one-year mark. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet expressed deep concern over the state of emergency Ethiopia's government imposed Tuesday with, quote, sweeping powers, unquote, of detention and military conscription. Ethiopia denies rights abuses by its forces and blames the Tigray Liberation Front. For reaction from Addis Ababa on the UN report, I spoke with VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir.
The Ethiopian Prime Minister did not reject it, but he said he has serious reservations about it. He said he would set up a joint civilian military task force to investigate the claims of abuse made in the report. However, Eritrea, which you know has forces in Ethiopia helping the government, they called the report utterly false, so they've rejected it. In terms of what happens next, there was a whole very in-depth section about recommendation, and that's what these sorts of joint investigative task force do. They go in and they see the situation. They can't prosecute or anything. Their mandate is to investigate and corroborate. And so now they've made a bunch of recommendations to all the parties. They're saying you need to stop the human rights violations, stop the fighting, and protect civilians, number one. And then specifically to the Ethiopian government, they are calling for a prompt, thorough, impartial investigation. And they also made recommendations to the government of Eritrea, telling them to take steps to make sure that all violence by their forces against civilians rain stops. But you know, it's worth noting that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed of Ethiopia said that the Eritrean forces would be out of Ethiopia months ago. Monitors say they're still there.
Previous calls and previous pleas and even threats of sanctions by the U.S. and some other bodies have not been able to stop what people say is crimes against humanity, war crimes. Do you get a sense that this particular report might bring some results?
The general hope is that the fighting will stop, that the parties will realize there's no military solution to this, that you can continue fighting on the field, you can continue committing atrocities and making civilians suffer, and in the case of Ethiopia, starving them. But at the end of the day, all conflicts end up at the negotiating table. So if this can push the parties towards a negotiated settlement, then great. But because part of peace is justice, right? You have to go hand in hand. So I think the main concern right now is to de-escalate the situation in Ethiopia. And we heard from the Secretary General of the United Nations today. He reacted to the report. He said the report's findings are extremely serious and that all parties have violated international human rights law, international humanitarian law, and refugee law in the violations they've carried out. And he's just really concerned that the state of emergency that was issued yesterday by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed will aggravate the human rights situation. He doesn't want that to be an excuse for the government to clamp down more on people. And he reiterated again that ultimately the only way to solve the situation is through an inclusive dialogue and negotiations. So I think that's what it always comes back to at the end of the day. In every conflict we see at the United Nations, it always comes back to the parties need to sit down and talk. It's the only way to resolve it.
Does this report strengthen the hands of regional bodies like the AU in trying to find a solution to this problem?
Anytime light is shed on human rights violations, it's good and it helps in many ways. So certainly it could help mediation efforts if they so choose to rely upon it. But I think we heard from the U.S. Special Envoy on the Horn of Africa yesterday, Jeffrey Feltman. He spoke at a think tank in Washington, D.C., and he hadn't seen the report yet, he said. But he did say that all parties really need to implement the recommendations immediately. Like that would be something the United States would be looking at as they go forward in dealing with reacting to the situation.
That's VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with me from New York. African nations at the COP26 summit have criticized rich countries for failing to meet their promise of giving billions of dollars to help them cope with climate change. But agreements to protect rainforests and slash methane emissions were welcomed, as Henry Ridgewell reports from the conference in Glasgow, Scotland.
The world's wealthiest nations, the G20, account for 80% of greenhouse gas emissions. But scientists say poorer countries, particularly in Africa, are suffering the worst impacts of climate change. Rich nations pledged in 2009 to give developing countries $100 billion a year to help them deal with climate change. But the target date has been put back to 2023. At the COP26 summit Tuesday, African leaders voiced their anger.
Those same nations are, however, insisting that we abandon the opportunity for rapid development of our economies. That would be tantamount to enshrining in the global community inequality of the highest order.
Their appeals failed to shift the timetable, but the frustration was tempered by progress on other vital climate emergencies. Over 100 nations agreed to end deforestation by 2030, backed by close to $20 billion in public and private funding. Signatories included Brazil. Deforestation has increased in the Amazon under Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro to its highest level in a decade, and some are skeptical of his pledge.
Mas isso não vai resolver o problema. Não vai ajudar o nosso povo, não vai resolver o problema social de nossas comunidades, onde falta água, onde está desmatando, onde está a contaminação. Não vai resolver esse tipo de problema. São apenas investimentos que dá liberdade para que as empresas continuem fazendo suas poluições.
Over 100 countries also signed a global methane pledge to cut emissions by 30% by 2030. Methane is 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide in driving global warming.
It's an incredibly important progress in addressing the climate crisis. because we can now think about methane emissions separately from CO2 and recognizing that reduction of methane represents an enormous lever for making progress in reducing the rate of warming.
China and Russia, two of the world's biggest methane emitters, did not sign. There may be no big breakthrough at this summit, but organizers say the smaller, targeted agreements on protecting rainforests, cutting methane, or helping vulnerable island states all add up to significant progress. The absence of the Chinese, Russian, and Brazilian presidents has led to questions over how effective the summit will be in curbing global warming. Host British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said he was cautiously optimistic. World leaders have now returned home. Their teams of negotiators will now decide the fate of the summit, and many scientists say the future of planet Earth. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News at the COP26 summit, Glasgow.
In Lagos, Nigeria, the death toll from the collapse of a building Monday has risen to 22 as rescuers continue digging through the rubble in a search for survivors. Experts say the collapse was likely the result of poor construction and weak oversight, and are worried that such catastrophes could happen again. Timothy Obiezu reports.
The search for survivors continued Wednesday at the site of the building collapse in Ikoyi, an upper-class area of Lagos State. So far, 9 survivors have been pulled out of the rubble and taken to hospitals. Scores more are reported missing. Search teams have found 22 bodies. On Tuesday, Lagos State Governor Babajide Sanwo-Olu visited the site and later suspended the state's building control head. Lagos State also launched an independent investigation into the collapse. But Festus Adebayo, founder of the Housing Development Advocacy Network, who visited the site, says authorities have been careless.
We are careless. We are just careless. We have recommended, the building code is there, and we have said 21 years jail, but nobody has been jailed. It has all been media hype. Noise, noise, noise.
Lagos State authorities halted the construction of the building in June for not meeting standard structural requirements. The local president of the Nigerian Institute of Architects, David Majekuduni, says the institute doesn't know if the problem was fixed before the workers were asked to return to the site.
You seal up a site, definitely there are processes that you need to do before the site can be open. We can tell now whether the process went through.
Lagos authorities say they are assessing the possible impact of the collapse on nearby structures. Building collapses, unfortunately, are not uncommon in Lagos State, which has a population of 21 million people and thousands of high-rise structures. Adebayo says these catastrophes are not good for investment or business.
How do you think the whole world will be seeing us? How do you think, what impression they'll be having about our professionals? You will discover that a lot of people will no more be going for high-rise buildings.
On Tuesday, rescuers received several phone calls from people trapped under the debris. No new calls came in Wednesday, and experts say that as the days go by, the chances of survival for trapped victims are getting slimmer. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Analysts say the high-profile arrest of Iranian agents in Turkey last month is the latest sign of growing tensions between the neighbors. This as Turkey expands its influence in the Caucasus region at Iran's expense. Dorian Jones reports for VOA from Istanbul.
Turkish security forces arresting Iranian agents who Turkey says were attempting to kidnap an Iranian dissident. Video of the October arrest was widely distributed, embarrassing Tehran. The incident comes as Iran and Turkey are in a mounting power struggle in the Caucasus. Turkish and Israeli military hardware were vital to Azerbaijan's forces ouster of the Armenian army last year from the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave, a conflict analysts say that diminished Iran's influence in the region.
Now the Israeli-Azerbaijani ties are closer. The fact now that Turkish-Azerbaijani ties is much closer. The fact that there is a new geopolitical reality in South Caucasus, in which the Iran's role has been downsized, in contrast, the Turkish role has increased and the Russian role Russia has asserted its primacy. All of them are the factor that very much makes Iran unhappy.
Iran is now pushing back, along with stepping up diplomatic efforts. In October, Tehran held military exercises for the first time in decades on the Azeri border.
Now Iran is putting pressure on Azerbaijan. Diplomatic ties between Iran, Armenia and Russia regarding the Caucasus are getting closer. Iran is organizing, is holding military exercises right next to its border with Azerbaijan. So it can be said that there is a tension in the region that will be durable in the long run.
In a show of support, Turkey held joint military exercises with Azeri forces close to the Iranian border after Tehran's show of force, underscoring how important Ankara is to Baku. Turkey's deepening military ties with Iran's eastern neighbor, Pakistan, are also adding to Tehran's unease, observers say, by stoking sectarian tensions. Turkey and Pakistan are Sunni Muslim countries, and Iran is Shia.
Tehran observes the deepening of the cooperation in security and in military between Pakistan and Turkey, as well as between Turkey, Azerbaijan and Pakistan, because the perception of the regional politics, of the dynamics in the greater Middle East takes place in Iran within of the framework of sectarianism and of the Shia perception.
Iran's crisis-ridden economy depends on trade with Turkey. And that, analysts say, allows Ankara to take a robust stance against Tehran. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
In other news, according to the Associated Press, an independent Pentagon review has concluded that the UN drone strike that killed innocent Kabul civilians and children in the final days of Afghan war was not caused by misconduct or negligence, and it doesn't recommend any disciplinary action. A senior defense official familiar with the report said the review, done by Air Force Lieutenant General Sami Saeed, found there were breakdowns in communication and in the process of identifying and confirming the target of the bombing. But Saeed concluded that the mistaken strike happened despite prudent measures to prevent civilian deaths, said the official, who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss a report not yet released. As Inspector General of the Air Force, Saeed had no direct connection to Afghanistan operations and thus was deemed an independent judge on the matter. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afor. Industry statistics appear to show that lobster producers in Australia are selling millions of dollars worth of the crustaceans to China despite Beijing's unofficial trade restrictions. Experts say fishing companies are taking advantage of the so-called, quote, grey channels, unquote. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
In November, China imposed what experts said was an unofficial ban on Australian lobster imports. The trade was worth hundreds of millions of dollars. China had been buying more than 90% of lobsters exported from Australia. However, figures released by the organisation representing a major Australian lobster producer have shown a sharp rise in exports due to what's known as grey trade. The term refers to the selling of goods through indirect and unofficial channels. The Western Rock Lobster Council, an organisation that represents the lobster industry in Western Australia, has reported that exports from Western Australia to Hong Kong rose from very low levels in October 2020 to more than 300 metric tonnes in March 2021. Experts believe the consignments were almost certainly shipped and sold in mainland China. Restrictions on Australian lobster exports to China are part of the simmering trade dispute between the two countries, which has also affected shipments of Australian coal, wine, barley and other commodities. China has imposed restrictions and tariffs on these goods. Jeffrey Wilson is an international commerce expert at the Perth US Asia Centre, a research think tank. He says the grey trade in lobsters would be mainly controlled by importers in China, who are keen on circumventing Chinese government restrictions.
The reason that you're getting a grey trade happening in lobsters and not in coal or not in barley is it reflects it's one area where there was almost complete mutual interdependence. Australia completely relied on China for the market for lobsters, and China completely relied on Australia for the supply of them.
Wilson says unlike goods traded in the so-called black markets operating in the shadows, which might have some aspect of illegality, grey market sales may operate outside official channels but don't break the law. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Over the past years, the so-called healing crystal trends has resurfaced in the wellness industry, even though the stones have no scientifically proven health benefits. Karina Bafrazian has the story.
Becky Waddell is the owner of Take Care Boutique, a store that sells cosmetics and spa products in Washington, D.C. She says that for a long time she had treated her love for semi-precious stones purely as a hobby, until she realized crystals have become a part of the beauty industry.
After a while, a few clients had mentioned, oh, I wish that you had crystals here. And I was like, okay, sounds great. Like, everybody loves them.
Crystals have long been on the fringe of the wellness industry, but they've gotten a boost from the pandemic. Waddell says she's working to meet demand because interest in crystal therapy keeps growing. Like their medicinal characteristics, the prices of healing crystals vary a lot, ranging from $20 to $5,000. Celebrities have also given the crystal industry a boost. Supermodel Naomi Campbell says she always carries crystals in her purse. A singer, Adele, mentioned that her less-than-perfect Grammy performance wasn't a success because she had lost her good luck crystal. And actress Gwyneth Paltrow even sells healing crystals on her Goop website. But doctors are skeptical and say there is no evidence crystals actually help.
There's no scientific evidence to show that healing crystals can help in any way with treating illnesses, diseases. But I do think that there is room for people to have faith in certain things that can increase their positivity and their own mental health. And by increasing your mental, like increasing your resilience to mental health and also just your general happiness, you are, you can also boost your immune system. So is it from the healing crystals? No. Does it have to always come from healing crystals? No. It can come from so many different things in our life, right? It can come from spending time with our loved ones. It can come from exercising.
Crystals also come with political issues. Despite the fact that mining for healing crystals takes place in about a quarter of U.S. states, most of them are imported. A number of deposits are in Afghanistan, where no safety measures are in place for those who mine the semi-precious stones. According to Global Witness, a human rights organization, every year Afghanistan gets roughly $20 million from sales of blue malachite. Tim McDonald, a reporter for Quartz, says the profits from selling Afghan blue malachite go straight to the Taliban.
To the extent that the Taliban is the current government of Afghanistan and, you know, revenue from mineral resources, you know, flows into the treasury of that country, then I suppose, yes, that would be supporting the Taliban. And I think that, you know, it's a question for anyone who wants to, any company that wants to work in this space.
And though some collectors are on the fence about the ethics of buying Afghan-produced crystals, experts and sellers believe that the demand isn't expected to drop anytime soon, thanks to COVID-19. Karina Befredjian for VOA News, Washington.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Opo in Washington, wishing you a pleasant week ahead.
This is the Voice of America.
Washington. Bah, bah, bah.